NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Flight Safety Detectives. I'm Miles O'Brien and I'm joined today by Todd Curtis and John Golia. And we're going to look at a couple of, I guess you could call them broken arrows. Two aero crashes in the southeastern United States, June and September of 2022, which have some interesting parallels about pilots not paying a lot of attention, mechanics not paying a lot of attention, and other aspects of the risks of flying that first flight after a big bunch of maintenance. So let's go first of all to June 6, 2022. We're in Panama City, Florida. Three people aboard a Pipo Aero. This is really pretty much all you need to know about this crash is the pilot approaches the aircraft. And because we live in, what do you call it, Todd? The surveillance state? Is that what it is?
The national surveillance state.
Because we live in the national surveillance state, we have video proof that he walked up to this aircraft. It was sitting above a huge pool of oil. And he showed no signs of doing any sort of pre-flight inspection. The passengers arrive, they get in, they take off. And off they go. Surprise, surprise, no oil pressure, high temperatures, engine failure, and of course, the dreaded turn back to the airport, which caused a stall spin, and thus the two fatalities and one serious injury. All right, gentlemen, this, for a pilot to approach an aircraft with a pool of oil above it or below it, is and not do anything about it. I think on the face of it, that's something that is obvious, but let's go through it for again. I know, John, you like to talk about the value of a pre-flight inspection and doing it perhaps more than one time.
Yes. Yes. So when you approach your airplane, just like a car, you know, I just had a neighbor of mine. I saw him out looking around his car because he saw a little slick of oil on the, it had recently rained. We should be doing the same with our airplanes. And I have done, I right here in New England, I did an accident years ago where the exact same thing happened. An oil leak while he was running his airplane up and he didn't even see it.
Well, in this case,
it just defines description.
The oil leak was happening overnight because the first flight after maintenance was the previous day. The accident pilot flew it to this particular airport. And the following days when they took off on the accident day, there's a photograph we're showing on the video version of this that shows the oil patch on the ground was about 5 feet across. So we're not talking about a tiny little slick. We're talking about something very, very obvious.
Yeah, it was a deep water horizon kind of scenario out there practically. So let's talk a little bit about, Todd, you kind of bored in a little bit on the equipment and parts that were used in this process of repairing the aircraft or maintaining the aircraft. There might have been a wrong part put on board, right?
Well, there was a repair done prior to the previous day's flight. And the installation manual for what was done specifically said a flexible hose should have been used to reconnect the parts that had been taken off. And there was a rigid hose used. Now, I can go into some detail as to the accident report had some wriggle room as to whether it should be a flexible or a non-flexible line, but the installation manual, and we have that on the screen as well, was quite clear. Because this particular part of the aircraft was subject to vibration and rapid fatigue wear because of that. This was fairly rapid. The previous day, there was a few hours of flying. All indications were normal. And apparently something happened after that first flight that led to the oil leak that you saw earlier.
Okay. So the other aspect of this incident, which all pilots should take note of, is the dreaded turn back to the runway. My understanding is he began, you know, he loses the engine pretty quickly because it was probably very little oil in it when he took off. The fact that he wasn't checking his oil pressure and temperature prior to departure is yet another factor of indicating a pilot not paying too much attention. But in this case, he reached an altitude of 1,200 MSL, which I'm not exactly sure what that is over the ground in Panama City, probably about 1,200 in Panama City. And he's 1.7 miles away from the runway he just took off on, or, well, actually the inverse of it, so, to be precise. So 1,200 feet and 1.7 miles with a steep 180-degree turn, you're never going to make that, right?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. You know, if you're not practicing those kinds of turns, you never should have attempt them. I mean, really, it takes an exceptional pilot, one that has practiced this a lot, to make this turn successfully, not lose so much altitude that you could never hope to get back to the airport. So that's why all the guidance out there tells you don't do it. Don't do it. And in fact, when I look at the sequence here, I get really frustrated because he took off over nothing but open terrain, marsh, low scrub. He never should have tried to return. He should have looked ahead of him and put it down in an open area. There was plenty of open areas in front of him.
And there's also no real clear indication here as to how much time was happening between the time the pilot noticed something was wrong to the pilot realized that he had to do something about it. Was it 2 seconds? Was it 15 seconds? Sure, it might have been 1,000 feet above that ground level when the problem manifested itself. But how high was it before the solution, or at least his proposed solution, manifested itself in his head?
You know, speaking of what's in your head, I think it's really good practice for pilots to have kind of these, you know, red box items in their head where they, you don't even have to think, because in that situation, you're really might be hard pressed to go through a proper checklist. You need to have it figured out in your head. It's like a V1 kind of cut scenario. You need to say to yourself, if I'm at 1200 feet on departure and I lose an engine, I'm going straight in no matter what. You want to have that in your head. So you're not even in that moment thinking, oh, maybe I can turn around. Because then, you know, the difference between, you know, landing, getting close to stall speed and finding an open spot, or even landing in some trees at that speed, as opposed to turning and stall spin, where you go in, you know, with really no chance of survival, is so significant. I don't think there's much question. First of all, obviously, if the pilot had done a pre-flight, he'd be alive today, he and the others. But in this case, there's a good chance they would have made it if they just gone straight, as you said, John, to an area there that appears to be open, kind of marshy. You know, obviously would have been a totaled airplane, but you'd live to tell the story.
And another part of the story that I think is important, it had been going through some maintenance before this, and according to the report, the pilot, or into the public docket, the pilot was part of the team that did the maintenance on this aircraft. Wasn't the person who signed off on it, but apparently this person had intimate knowledge of what was done to the aircraft. So I don't know what was going through this person's head, but it's not like they rented the airplane and they have no emotional connection to it. This is something where something was done, he had a hand in it. Did that figure into his decision in trying to do that impossible turn? Or did it figure into his decision of not doing the pre-flight. It's not clear.
You might have hit on something there, Todd. He did the work. He probably thought he had intimate knowledge of the aircraft and he didn't need to do a pre-flight. After all, I just ripped this engine apart, you know, a day ago. I know everything about this aircraft. Maybe that's what happened. I don't know. But, you know, you always want to check your work, right, John?
No question. And have someone else look over your shoulder sometimes.
Absolutely.
Even though it doesn't call for an inspector to watch every step of what a mechanic does. And I can tell you, I've been called out on jobs more times than I can count. Just somebody isn't comfortable. Hey, can take a walk out to the airplane, take a look at what I just did.
It was also unclear who the two passengers were and what relationship existed there, whether this was a get-the-rightest situation or trying to impress someone. It's unclear. But there were two passengers who went down with this aircraft as well.
Yeah.
Let's go back. Before you go on, let's go back a minute about the pre-flight and pre-cleaning.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All right. Before you go flying, you find it in many, many publications. They talk about planning for the unexpected. And one of the things that's most obvious that I see all the time when people are talking about this, and I hear it at the airport often, is what do you do if you get an engine failure on takeoff? Right. He should have known what to do before he left. And to your point, Miles, he should have had that in his head. I know I'm taking off in the southeast direction, whatever it was, and I have plenty of open area in front of me. In fact, he has open area on the ends of both of the runways at this airport. All right, so he should know I'm going to put it down if I have an engine failure. I'm not coming back because I don't practice that turn every time I fly. Yeah. I'm not good at it, and I'm going to put it down. And I'm going to look at the map and say, okay, that's where I'm going to put it down. It's all marshland on the side where he crashed. So there's nothing there, no big trees there, none of that obstacles. It's just scrub brush, grass, and marsh, which, you know, landing on marshland, if you're not careful, can be hazardous to your health too. But it's a hell of a lot better than this outcome.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I don't think it's overstating it that if you're not kind of always thinking of the worst case scenario, you're not doing a good job as a pilot. It's like, you know, when you're on a cross country, you know, that assumption, when I take off, I'm going to kind of assume for a moment this engine is going to fail. Sort of have that mindset. Or as you're doing a cross country, you know, what would happen if the propeller stops spinning now? You should always, you know, what I used to do flying my Cirrus is I would keep the list of nearest airports screen up on the Garmin 430. So I always knew where that nearest airport was, you know, and you just got to kind of think that way. And that's what makes you safe, because if you're spending time thinking about it, or you're trying, hey, maybe I can try this, it's not the time to be doing possibilities and hypotheticals. You want to stick with what is tried and true if you want to live to fly another day.
Well stated.
All right, gentlemen, let's move on to the next one. There's some interesting, some parallels here. You know, this is Conway, South Carolina. We're now in September of 22. This is an aircraft shortly after departure. And the thing to, which always stands out in these reports, this is the first flight following maintenance, loss of engine power. Tried to do a forced landing onto a gravel road, but the airplane impacted trees and power lines. Two people, both people aboard died. What happened was on this, and John, I want you to help me with this, because this ultimately was a failure of the vacuum system. Now, I know a lot of pilots like me would think vacuum system, wait a minute, that has to do with your artificial rising, all your gyro systems. But there is a link here to the oil system, which I think we need to get into. And it's important to point out before we do this, though, that this was VMC, visual meteorological conditions. So a typical vacuum failure, like we mostly think about, is that tiny little piece, that little impeller in there that spins around. And, you know, it's like a $5 part, but if you're in the soup, you can really get yourself disoriented. In this case, it appears a gasket was not attached properly after maintenance, and it may have led to a breach in the oil system. John, walk us through that a little bit, if you could.
Well, just remember before we start, the vacuum system for your instruments is not is totally separate from any vacuum that's generated by your engine.
Okay.
All right.
So this is a separate system.
Separate system. So although we had a vacuum pump issue and an instrument issue, it should not have affected his engine. But apparently he had also a separate issue because of oil pressure problems, actually loss of oil pressure, that resulted in his engine not being able to produce sufficient power. So in this case, hang on a second here.
I got a question for you while you're thinking about this, John, because this is really in your wheelhouse. The director of maintenance, who is an A&P, signed off on the paperwork to return the airplane. He stated that the vacuum pump had been removed, but did not address the installation of the dry pad gasket or vacuum pump. The mechanic who completed the removal of the vacuum pump and installation of the vacuum pump cover stated that when he removed the vacuum pump, the gasket was still attached to it. So there's confusion about who did the work and who's responsible for the work. In the end, the director of maintenance, the A&P, did not review the work in detail. So from your perspective, all your years as an A&P on the board, et cetera, what is the responsibility of the A&P in that situation?
Well, you're assuming that the person who did the work wasn't an A&P, and the report's not clear on that. But in any event, the person who puts his signature on the line is 100% responsible. 100%. So that is his burden. He's saying that he checked it and it's okay. Now, the FAA might come back after the person who actually did the work and take some action against him. Maybe just the action in that case might just be a warning letter in his case. But the person who signed for the work is 100% responsible for it. And that gasket, if he noted that gasket was still attached to the pump, where was his head? You know, I can remember when the Eastern Airlines oil plugs issue came up on the L-1011 in a Rolls-Royce engine. They knew that the plugs came to them without O-rings on them. They knew it. But complacency set in that case. The O-rings were always installed by the supervisor on the shift and who actually kept the oil plugs in his office. And so when the mechanic needed a new plug to replace the one he just removed, they'd go into the foreman's office and take a plug out of the drawer where they stored them with the O-ring on it. One day a guy comes in, he needs a plug, he takes one out of the drawer, goes out, puts it in, puts all three of them in, one in each engine, and none of them had O-rings on them. Now there's a case of complacency, and very similar to the complacency that this A&P has shown by knowing that the gasket left with the old fuel, vacuum pump and not doing something about it. You know, that something could have been just making note of it, putting a tag on it, saying vacuum gasket's not, you know, just a tag that said gasket would be enough to put the light bulb on in somebody's head. So the first step right here is complacency at the very least.
Well, and the first flight after maintenance probably should be a few circuits around the dog patch, as it were, before you get off on a cross country. That was always my theory. Todd, another thing that's kind of interesting about this, aside from the fact that they were off on a cross country, they departed Myrtle Beach. The first thing he said to air traffic control is having trouble maintaining assigned headings, which of course would bespeak some kind of vacuum system failure. But, you know, one of the things that happens time and again in accidents is that things like this happen or you get a bad indicator and you tend to fixate on that problem to the exclusion of looking at other instruments and just flying the aircraft, right? Because it was the famous L-1011. They were focused on the gear warning. They had a gear light, I believe, and they're focused on fixing that, and they literally flew it right into the ground. I believe that's the scenario. Does that sound right, John?
What happened was they tripped altitude hold off. Three guys in the cockpit,
yeah.
And they had, when they decided to go out over the Everglades, they engaged the altitude hold of the autopilot, and they were making circles out there. The first officer was flying, the captain and another flight crew member who was on the airplane was trying to solve the light problem, and somewhere along the line, they tripped the altitude hold off, and the airplane didn't do a nosedive. It just slowly lost altitude.
Now, similar, not similar, but perhaps similar to this case in Conway, South Carolina, there was a problem with the heading indicator, with the compass, and they were concerned about that, and they tried to get back to the airport. At the same time, there was another issue going on with the airplane, which was the oil leaking out of the system, and it's unclear whether or not they were distracted to the point that they were not aware of this ultimately more serious issue and didn't have the time and the space to make a proper decision to land the aircraft. These are two fairly experienced people. One was several hundred hours of flight as a private pilot, and the other was a certified flight instructor with instrument rating. And this was a nice, clear day as well. So here's a situation where there was a problem, and there was another problem, and they ultimately were not able to land the aircraft.
Don't fixate. You know, that scan, that instrument scan is so important, especially when you're troubleshooting a problem, because it's very easy. You know, we always talk about aviate, navigate, communicate. Aviate is an important thing. And I will say this, you know, you can't imagine them just trying to figure out why their DG or their artificial horizon isn't working and focusing on that and not seeing pressure loss and temperature increase as a result of an oil pressure situation. The two things clearly linked, but, you know, one kind of happening in an insidious fashion after the other has captured your attention. It's definitely a fatal pilot trap. There's no question. But I will say this, Todd, what is your policy on first flights after maintenance?
One, know that it is the first flight after maintenance. And two, right, check and see what was done. Did somebody do run-ups on this? Did the maintenance people do a write-up I should review before I get into the airplane? Or should I say to myself, you know what? I don't want to be the first person testing this, given my fairly low time. Let someone else fly this airplane first. I'll pick another airplane today.
You agree on that one?
Yeah, I do agree with that. But Todd, go a step further. Tell everybody the story you had about the wing.
This was about a year and a half ago. I was going out to an airplane I'd flown several times at my aero club and was doing a pre-flight check. And I'm going through and looking at the wing. I moved the aileron. I thought, wow, these bolts look brand new. Spanking brand new. It's like, I looked at the other side. It's like, these look like they've been here for a while. What's going on here? I did a little digging, and it turns out this airplane had an incident where the wing was damaged. It had to be replaced. I was unaware of this. And in fact, I did a FOIA request of the NTSB and the FAA saying, hey, you know, I know there was something that happened to this airplane. Give me the details of this incident. And I went and got the details of it. Asked around also with our maintenance department there, you know, what happened with this? That sort of like got me in hot water because like, ooh, who the heck are you asking those questions? So instead of trying to get...
that's a good question. What do you mean? You're the one that's getting in the plane, right?
I had much more detailed information coming from the FAA and the NTSB than I did from my own maintenance department there at the Aero Club. So, you know, I recommend to people, hey, if you have an interest in what might be going on to the airplane, with your airplane, ask questions. Keep asking until you get an answer.
You know, it's funny. I think that's interesting because, you know, I've owned airplanes myself individually, which, you know, there's a certain accountability and knowledge that you develop if you own your own airplane. But if you're in a club, you really have to raise the bar a little bit on the scrutiny you give the aircraft, right? I mean, when that pre-flight should be even a little more careful than an airplane that you fly all the time and see all the time, because you do, it does become like a familiar shoe. But if you're flying aircraft, you know, multiple aircraft that have been flown by others in advance, you really got to pay attention.
And one extra thing I do in my pre-flight with my club aircraft, I'm always checking the floor of the cabin to see if somebody left something behind, because I don't want some object rolling around the floor, getting stuck behind the pedal. So I'm always very carefully looking and see pens, pencils, doesn't matter what it is. If there's some FOD there I don't want to see, I want to find it first.
You know, but one of the important points that I see in what you did that day, Todd, was you noticed the new hardware. Right. And in the pre-flights that I preach, I always talk about touching your airplane, looking at things. And that's just a visual cue that you need to go one step further. Why is there new hardware on here? What was done to the aircraft? Right. So there's no such thing as a bad find on a pre-flight. Right. If you see something unusual, you need to question it.
Absolutely. And that idea of touching, you know, in Japan, they have a culture in nuclear safety and so forth, where they point at things. You know, you're supposed to point at it and acknowledge. I like the touching. When I pre-flight my aircraft, I just stroke my hand all over the thing because it forces me to think about what I should be thinking about at that moment, right? My mind is not distracted because your mind kind of, you know, the hand-eye coordination, whatever you want to call it, it kind of makes you more focused in the process. And, you know, a rote process you have to be careful of, right? Because you can get complacent because you've done it a million times. And you have to assume, you know, it doesn't matter to the airplane that you've done it a million times if you're missing something.
You know, and mechanics do the same thing with their eyes. I have mechanics, even in the daylight, I've seen good mechanics using their flashlight looking at the airplane. Because I always thought a couple of reasons. One, we started our careers on midnight shift. And when you did your walk around, you used the flashlight to guide your eyes around what you're going to look for. And I see guys, even during the daylight, not so much bright sunlight, but maybe when it's not so bright, using a flashlight on the airplane, doing an inspection. Even though there's a light, you could really say there's enough light to see, like being in the wheel well, but they would use their flashlight to guide their eyes around what they're looking for. Those are all kinds of cues that we use as human beings to keep our attention focused on whatever it is we're looking at. And that's the whole point with a pre-flight and touching the airplane, like you said, Miles. I mean, it just keeps your attention where it needs to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I see that missing, especially in corporate operators. Boy, and I've said it on this program before, that my sitting in the office looking at otherwise competent pilots doing a pre-flight when they're more interested in avoiding puddles on the ground because they got their $200 pair of shoes on, or in a bright sunny day looking all around like they're on a sightseeing cruise. They walked around their airplane, but did they look at their airplane? Very little.
All right. So we have, in this case today, two Hyper Arrows, two crashes with some parallels, four people dead, one person seriously injured, and probably, I think we can say with some degree of certainty that it's very likely these people would be alive today were it not for some very simple steps. So it's a reminder in aviation, you know, where is the weak spot? The weak spot is often in the carbon-based entity at the controls. So with that, Todd, what you want to give us some final words?
Well, one of the reasons I picked these two, because on the surface, I thought, well, one's a fairly complicated one that has an oil issue, and the other is fairly obvious, this big oil puddle. But once we looked at these a little bit more closely, there were subtleties in both of these, where there are multiple opportunities for either the people on the maintenance side or the people flying the airplane to take actions that would have avoided this or taken actions that would have allowed a safe landing. So you don't have to be perfect in all ways when it comes to flying. But if you just did the competent thing at every stage, it'll greatly help you.
John, last word.
As usual, if you're going to go flying, do a good session of pre-planning. All right, which includes the what ifs. What if I lose an engine on takeoff? If this one of these flights, if that person had done that and would have thought through it, he wouldn't have turned back to the airport. He would have just put it down in front of him, which was wide open, marshy area. Right? They probably, three of them would still be here instead of just one. So do a good session of pre-planning what's going to happen. Play what if, worst case scenarios, given on the flight you have planned. When you get out to your airplane, do a good walk around, right? If it's your airplane, don't be complacent. Still look at it, touch it, wiggle it. See if there's something loose, something has happened. look at the ground to make sure we don't have an existing oil leak that may show up as drips because it's on the oil's along the belly of the airplane. And eventually gravity will pull it down to one point and drip. So after you get in the airplane, do a good pre-flight. Miles just had an excellent point where you run your hand across the instrument panel and what you're looking for to bring your mind into focus on why you got your hand up there. And then, as always, after you get off the ground, put that head on a swivel. There's an awful lot of airplanes out there and an awful lot of new people trying to learn how to fly, and they might not be doing the very best job, and they might have focus on their panel as well, not looking out the window. So please, please pay attention and fly safely.
And I'll just close it out by saying, you know, in both of these cases, clearly pilots wanted to get somewhere. In one case, there's a giant pool of oil beneath an aircraft. That is a sign that you might want to delay that mission. And then in the other case, that first flight after maintenance, it's worth doing a couple of circuits around the airport within gliding distance of a runway right after maintenance, just to make sure everything's working properly. So don't be so fixated on getting from point A to point B every time. It's sometimes, well, you know that expression, it's better to be on the ground wishing you were in the air rather than the other way around. So thank you, gentlemen. Another great edition of Flight Safety Detectives. Hopefully we all learned a little something, and we'll see you again soon.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.